Thank you so much for joining us today. I have Matt Engelbrecht here to have a discussion about cognitive disorders for primary care perspective, but I would like him to kind of discuss a little bit about himself.
Sure. I've been here at Astral Neurology Specialist for the last 18 years. We have three doctors here and four PAs, and we all see a little bit of everything.
So how should the primary care provider approach the evaluation of cognitive complaints?
There are going to be people across all age ranges that bring up cognitive complaints during their visits, but the majority of the complaints are going to come from an older population. So I think it's important to be able to recognize what issues could be due to normal aging and what issues should set off more alarm bells. We all have some decline with age. For most people, our cognitive processing speed, calculation abilities, short-term memory abilities can start to decline in our 40s, which is kind of a scary thing to think about. There can also be a steeper decline in these functions around the age of 60, along with more problems in areas such as visual spatial function, word finding, name recall, multitasking. With aging, it can also be more difficult to learn new technology. It would also be more common to need to rely on a calendar to keep track of events or appointments. If someone has minor issues in any of these areas but is still functioning independently and well in their daily lives, then you can often provide reassurance to them. There are some other more targeted questions that can help you get a sense of whether there are more concerning issues going on. These would include questions about whether there is frequent repetition of questions or statements, problems with forgetting appointments, problems with making poor decisions or getting lost in familiar locations while driving, difficulty with managing finances, difficulty operating household appliances, forgetting the month and year, decreased interest in doing hobbies, forgetting the names of friends and long-term acquaintances, if the patient is still working, if they're making mistakes on the job, if they cook, are they having difficulty following recipes, especially recipes that they've done before, or if they're having a loss of vocabulary. There actually is a questionnaire called the Ascertain Dementia 8 questionnaire, which specifically asks about many of these issues and can help determine whether someone is experiencing meaningful cognitive impairment and requires further evaluation. I do often tell people that our brains are allowed to have glitches because a normal brain is not a perfect brain. If someone has one instance of an issue, such as forgetting an appointment, you know, losing their wallet, forgetting where they parked their car, but otherwise they're doing well in their daily life, I usually just try to reassure them. Getting a good cognitive history is very time consuming, and one of the challenges I often encounter is when I'm seeing someone for a different issue, such as headaches, and near the end of the visit they bring up cognitive concerns. I can only imagine what it is like in the primary care setting where you've already addressed 10 different issues and then the patient throws in at the end they have memory problems. One of my super shortcut questions in this situation is to ask, do the memory issues prevent you from doing anything now that you used to be able to do without difficulty? If the answer is no, I know that I will still have to do an assessment, probably at another visit, but that it is not quite as urgent. Many of us also probably learn the maximum medical school that the physical exam starts the minute you enter the room with the patient. And I think that that's particularly true when we are evaluating cognition. If someone starts their history by telling me that their memory is absolutely terrible and then proceeds to talk at great length and in great detail about the problems they are experiencing, right off the bat, I have less of a suspicion that they have a degenerative condition and will tell the patient that their ability to provide such a comprehensive history is actually very reassuring. On the flip side, some people will appear to be communicating fluently and without difficulty, but then we'll launch into the same story or repeat the same question several times during our conversation, and this throws up more red flags.
Are there any other general health issues which can have an impact on cognitive function?
Absolutely. Whenever you see someone who is complaining about cognitive decline, it is important to think about not just degenerative conditions such as Alzheimer's, but other medical problems which might be causing or exacerbating the cognitive issues. Adequate sleep is incredibly important for proper brain function. Inadequate sleep or specific sleep disorders, especially sleep apnea, can lead to cognitive dysfunction. Chronic pain can cause slowed cognitive processing speed. Mood disorders often have a cognitive component, and certainly severe cases of depression can cause such a profound cognitive dysfunction that it can appear that an individual has dementia. Polypharmacy, of course, is also a significant problem. I think it's really important to remember those other factors, particularly when you're seeing someone who may not fit the typical profile for a degenerative process. For instance, we may see someone at a younger age than a dementia usually develops, say in their 40s, who is already encumbered by a number of health issues. It might be someone who has sleep apnea that is not being treated because they could not tolerate CPAP. They may be taking something like Benadryl for sleep. They may have a chronic pain condition, such as low back pain, for which they are taking chronic narcotics, and they might be struggling with a mood disorder as well. All of these problems could combine to slow their cognitive function, but you still might be able to reassure a patient that this likely doesn't add to having dementia. I also wanted to briefly mention perimenopause, because this is a topic that comes up in our clinic quite a bit. A number of studies have shown that cognitive symptoms are incredibly common in perimenopausal women. I'm not a perimenopause expert, and I think that the causes of these cognitive symptoms are still not well understood, and they may relate to a number of different issues for which there are not specific proven treatments. There is some emerging evidence that starting hormone replacement therapy at the right time might help with cognitive function, but I think there's a lot more to understand about this issue. However, it can still be useful to reassure patients that what they are experiencing is not unusual, that it is not the same thing as having a degenerative process such as Alzheimer's, and that there is a potential for improvement in cognitive function after perimenopause.
What are the next steps if someone is having symptoms that suggest a problem beyond just normal aging?
At that point, you have to start thinking about whether the symptoms are, consistent with mild cognitive impairment or dementia. Mild cognitive impairment is defined as having a noticeable decline in at least one aspect of cognition, such as memory, language, executive functioning, visual spatial abilities. But people with multiple cognitive, excuse me, mild cognitive impairment are generally still functioning well independently. Tasks may take more time to complete, and people may rely more on tools such as calendars and lists, but they are still able to complete tasks without assistance. Mild cognitive impairment can be related to a number of different issues. So we most often think of MCI related to Alzheimer's, but someone could also have MCI related to a stroke or to a previous TBI. Dementia means that someone is experiencing a decline in at least two cognitive areas, and that decline is severe enough that they're having difficulty functioning independently in their daily life. There are, of course, different types of dementia, and it is good to at least have a basic familiarity with the most common ones, with the understanding that there can be a lot of variability and overlap among the different types of dementia. Alzheimer's is usually characterized by short-term memory dysfunction first. Lewy body dementia is more likely to include hallucinations early in the course of the disease and can be associated with Parkinsonian features. Frontotemporal dementia is more likely to present with behavioral and psychiatric changes or language dysfunction. Vascular dementia, which is quite common, does not have a defined profile, but would be a higher suspicion if someone has multiple vascular risk factors or if their MRI shows previous strokes and significant microischemic changes. If the symptoms are beyond what you would expect with normal aging, then it is worthwhile to do a cognitive screening exam, usually an MMSE or a MoCA. It is important to remember that the score on this test does not establish the diagnosis. The score has to be used in conjunction with the history and results of other testing to try to arrive at a diagnosis. It is worthwhile to do blood work screening for hypothyroidism and B12 deficiency, and to do other basic blood work such as a CBC and CMP to make sure there is no evidence for general health issues such as renal disease or liver disease. It is also important to do brain imaging to see if there are any structural abnormalities that could be causing or contributing to the cognitive symptoms, especially mass lesions and strokes. It is ideal to do a brain MRI with volumetric analysis, which is something that you have to specifically request on the order. This analysis looks specifically for hippocampal and parietal atrophy. Significant atrophy in these areas is more likely to be associated with Alzheimer's. Unfortunately, in our area, Mission Radiology is the only place that does this type of MRI, so it might not be possible to do this for everyone. I do also often tell patients that the MRI tells us nothing about how the brain is functioning. It only tells us about the structure of the brain, so we can't make the diagnosis of dementia just based on the MRI alone.
When should primary care providers consider referring to a specialist?
I think that any time there is a suspicion that an individual has MCI or dementia, it is worth referring to a specialist. Though one of the realities is that there is a shortage of neurologists, both locally and nationally, and that shortage is not going anywhere soon. So I know that wait times sometimes can be very long. When a specialist sees someone for suspected MCI or dementia, we are more often doing biomarker testing to try to narrow the diagnosis. There have been a number of studies showing that misdiagnosis based on clinical symptoms alone is fairly common. Traditionally, doing biomarker testing has involved doing amyloid PET scans or doing an LP to determine whether there are pathologic changes in the brain that can lead to Alzheimer's. But there are now also a number of serum biomarker exams, which are fairly accurate. If the biomarker tests are positive and consistent with a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, then a person may be a candidate for one of the new amyloid targeting therapies, Leqembi or Kisunla. These have only been approved for individuals with MCI due to Alzheimer's pathology or mild Alzheimer's dementia. So someone really needs to be in the early stages of disease to see any benefit from these treatments. Amyloid accumulation in the brain is one of the factors contributing to the symptoms of Alzheimer's, and these medications actually do quite a good job of getting it out of the brain. However, they have only been shown to slow the progression of disease and not reverse it. So I always emphasize to patients and their families that these are not cures. The same goes for older medications like memantine or cholinesterase inhibitors such as donepezil. Donepezil may lead to some temporary improvement or stabilization of symptoms, but the long-term goal with both of these medications is to slow the progression of symptoms. And I think it's really important to set this expectation with patients and their families before starting treatment.
Makes sense. Is there anything else you would think is important for the primary provider to know?
I think that all providers are aware that we are going to be seeing more people with cognitive disorders as the population ages, but there also seems to be a heightened concern among our patients about the prospect of developing dementia. One study that I read showed that about half of people in their 40s believe that they will develop dementia. The actual prevalence of dementia is lower than that, but the study just shows us that this is an issue that is on people's minds when they think about their long-term health. I think it's really important to see dementia as a potentially preventable condition, which is certainly not how it was approached when I was in training. Because the pathologic changes of Alzheimer's start in the brain before the onset of symptoms, there may be a time when we will use the serum biomarker tests as routine screening tests to identify those who are at the highest risk for developing Alzheimer's before they are actually symptomatic. Much the same way as cancer screening is meant to identify pre-symptomatic individuals. Hopefully there will be treatments that are proven to prevent or delay the onset of dementia in these pre-symptomatic individuals. But there are definitely things we can do right now to prevent or delay dementia. Although age and genetics play a substantial role in determining an individual's risk of dementia, more and more research is emphasizing that there are modifiable risk factors such as hypertension, diabetes, heavy alcohol consumption, hyperlipidemia, smoking, depression, hearing loss. It depends on what study you read, but it is estimated that 20 to 45% of dementia cases could be prevented, delayed, or mitigated by addressing these factors. By mitigated, I mean that even if a person develops dementia, if these risk factors are addressed, then the dementia may progress more slowly or have less of an impact than it otherwise would. One thing that I think it's important to emphasize is that assessing and treating these risk factors is something that primary care providers are already going to be doing on a regular basis. So preventing dementia does not necessarily add another step to their visits, which are already jam-packed. When we see people in our clinic for cognitive issues, we try to spend a lot of time emphasizing the importance of living a healthy lifestyle and preserving cognitive health. Physical exercise, not surprisingly, is incredibly important for brain health. There have been many studies which have shown that regular exercise can help prevent or mitigate dementia. Moderate exercise is fine. I often tell my patients that they do not have to be huffing and puffing or dripping with sweat to see the benefits of exercise. Social activity is important as well. Social isolation itself is one of the risk factors for developing dementia. Mental activity is also very important, and anything that challenges the brain can be useful. Many of us get these challenges just by navigating our everyday lives. For instance, every time you have to manage your finances, you are challenging your brain. Reading is an excellent brain challenge. Playing a musical instrument and learning a new language can be particularly beneficial. I also often get questions about brain training apps. And though there is nothing harmful about these, there is not much strong evidence that they actually enhance day-to-day cognitive function. I also often get questions about nutraceuticals. There are a very large number of supplements on the market that claim to support or improve brain health and function. This is a multi-billion dollar industry. I think I read one study that across the world, it's in the hundreds of billions. I don't necessarily feel that there's anything unsafe about these products, but there really is not much evidence to suggest that they actually provide any benefit. If someone wants to try one, I don't argue against it, but I don't recommend them either. I'm a big believer that if you're eating well, then your body is getting everything it needs. And yeah, not surprising, eating well is good for our brains. There is an eating plan called the MIND diet, which is a combination of the DASH and Mediterranean diet. There is some evidence that the MIND diet can reduce the risk of dementia. It essentially divides foods between ones that are good for our brains and ones that can be detrimental to brain health. It does not eliminate any food entirely, but gives guidelines for how much of the good foods we should be consuming each week and how much of the detrimental ones are too much. The MIND diet does allow for up to one alcoholic drink per day, but I advise almost everyone that I see who is having cognitive symptoms to try to make most days alcohol-free. The real take-home point is that we have a chance to intervene and reduce the risk of dementia by promoting these lifestyle factors. Everyone would benefit from living as healthy a life as possible, but some people may be particularly receptive to this advice. For instance, you may be seeing someone whose parent or grandparent was just diagnosed with dementia, and now that person has a heightened concern about their own risk for dementia. That's the perfect time to talk about the active steps that they can take to keep their brain as healthy as possible.
There is actually a recent study that said if you go from 2,000 steps to 5,000 steps, especially the time frame that they get the most cognitive and physical benefit, is going from completely sedentary to not so sedentary.
Yeah, it's interesting to look at those studies and to see how the benefits start to plateau as the exercise becomes more intense or the exercise time or
And in my personal population that I work with, I'm just trying to get them to move. And so I even tell them that getting up and walking three laps around the house is more than not walking any laps around the house. I was like, I'm not trying to get you to go run a marathon. I just need you to move a little bit more. And those patients, just that tiny amount seems to be more than a significant, that's where the most benefit seems to be showing in some of the studies.
I had one patient who has multiple sclerosis, whose gait is challenging, definitely, but she still gets out and exercises all the time, and she says it's difficult, but as she puts it, she's still lapping the people who are sitting on the couch. So I thought that's a great attitude, and we should make a poster and hang that up, somewhere.
So, I mean, because everyone thinks working out and exercise, you're huffing and puffing and you're sweating and you're pumping iron. And when you're just like, I just need movement.
Right. Indeed.
That was a very good talk.